This is an ABC podcast.
The carnivore diet. It sounds prehistoric, to be honest, a little bit scary, but it's a trend that's being pumped by a lot of influencers. So does it really make you less anxious, more healthy? Because there are some experts who don't reckon it does. G'day, Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Soon we're going to be speaking about this diet and the kinds of people who are drawn to it. Maybe it's something you've tried. Also, Serena Williams, one of the world's most influential and loved sports people, is retiring from tennis. This is massive news. We're going to get into that in a bit. But first,
Hack.
I most definitely don't have a place in industrial mining.
On Triple J.
You know, there's been a lot of attention on the culture in the mining industry this year, especially the treatment of women. Just a couple of months ago, you'll remember a massive report with the title Enough is Enough found that women in Western Australia's fly-in, fly-out mining industry are facing abuse and harassment on a daily basis, and it called for urgent action. But still, we're hearing disturbing stories about the treatment of women, and not just those in the industry either. I want to introduce you to Amber Lilly. Amber is the deputy editor of a newspaper called the Kalgoorlie Miner. It's in WA's Goldfields region, so a big mining area. She's used to covering these kinds of stories for her work, but now Amber is making the news for something she alleges happened to her after a mining conference recently. Let's let her explain. She's with us now. G'day, Amber. Thanks so much for coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a journalist in Kalgoorlie, and last week you were covering a big mining conference called the Diggers and Dealers Mining Forum. Firstly, are you able to explain what this conference is, how big it is, and what it's all about?
So the Diggers and Dealers Mining Forum, it's in its 31st year, the one that's just gone, and it's basically just a massive talk fest between executives, industry leaders, investment bankers, lawyers, anyone who has anything to do with the mining industry or anyone who wants to have anything to do with the mining industry. It's Australia's most prestigious and the biggest mining conference in Australia, and it's one of the biggest in around the world. So it attracts a lot of international attention as well as taking our headlines pretty much for the whole week.
You've written this big piece about the kind of behaviour that you witnessed and experienced at the conference and on the sidelines. What happened?
So during my week with Diggers and Dealers, it sort of started on the Sunday evening, which is the eve of Diggers, and then it goes from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and kind of culminates in a massive gala. During the day, there's conferences and presentations from top mining leaders, and then in the evenings and the afternoons, there's sideline events that are hosted and supported by various companies in industry and various peak bodies and organisations. So whilst attending those events, I encountered so much what people call casual sexism and just in general, this really icky feeling of how a lot of men in industry treat women that are associated with the industry or who are there and sort of experiencing the Diggers and Dealers conference and also those sideline events.
What kinds of things were you hearing people say?
So the first Diggers and Dealers sort of sideline event that I went to, there was a very average comedian that made a pretty average sex joke in front of, you know, a whole bunch of people at a charity fundraiser, and that sort of was where it all began. From there, it just sort of descended, to be honest. You know, there's people saying, commenting on my outfit every day, not something that they did to my male colleagues. I was told at one point that maybe I should get up and be a skimpy barmaid. We've seen, you know, other women experience similar sort of things, and there's also just a huge misrepresentation of women and gender diversity at the event in general.
And it wasn't just harassment that you're saying that you witnessed. You allege that you were groped at one point as well.
Yeah, so that incident happened at a networking event on the sideline of the forum, and I was sexually propositioned by a man who worked in mining before being groped, and then he sort of followed me into the crowd as I walked away from him. It was a pretty uncomfortable and confronting scenario, and I always thought and generally have been the kind of person that would stand up for myself in those situations, but it was such a vulnerable situation, and I was quite shocked that it happened given the professional environment that it was meant to be at.
Did it surprise you, like in this year in particular, when there's so much attention on the treatment of women in this particular industry, in this state?
I'd like to say that it was shocking, but I think just given the stories that we've heard come out of the industry and come out of similar events like this, I suppose it didn't shock me as much as it probably should have, and that's probably just as disappointing as the act.
So you decided to speak out publicly about this. Like, it was on the front page of your newspaper. Was that a hard decision to make? Because you are in a small community. It's a mining community. You're a local journalist. I don't imagine that was an easy thing to decide to do.
It definitely wasn't an easy thing to decide to do, but I think it was a really important thing that we did. And I obviously had some brilliant support from so many of my co-workers and my company, but it was something that we just felt, you know, going into this event, I was told that, nah, this stuff never happens. You're blowing it up in the media sort of thing. And then to actually get to the event and to have this happen, I just thought, if it's happened to me in front of a crowd and involving a crowd that know I'm the deputy editor at the newspaper, it must be happening to other women, and they might not have the platform and support to speak out. And I'm very privileged to have those things. So I thought, why not? Let's share this story.
So what's the response been like?
It's been mostly positive. Working in a pretty public job in a small town, I've heard most of it before, but it's always still surprising to get that negative feedback. I think people tend to forget that there actually is another person on the other end of this. So just because it's such a public case definitely doesn't mean that I'm not affected by those comments, particularly online and in my inbox. But there's been a lot of public figures coming out, commenting and apologising and sort of sharing the condemnation of this kind of behaviour. So it's definitely starting a conversation.
Have you heard from other women, like maybe other people in the mining industry getting in touch with you, anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a lot of men and women come out, and it's been disappointing but also pretty humbling to hear from other women who have had similar experiences or have experienced similar sexual misconduct both on site and at events and things like that. So that's been really, really nice to hear from other women who have experienced it. But I've had just as many men reach out and say that, you know, they're talking about it on site. And I think that's what it's all about, really creating that conversation and listening to other people's experiences and kind of growing and seeing where maybe you can do a little bit better in the future.
There's been big reports, as I said earlier, into the treatment of women in mining, in WA in particular. Like, we had the Enough is Enough report. We had Rio Tinto commission its own independent review, and it found sexism, bullying were systemic across its work sites. What's happening? Does there seem to be real efforts being made to address this culture? I mean, we're hearing a lot of research into it, studies into it, and the findings are horrible, but does it feel like that there are positive moves being made?
So there's definitely a lot of discussions about it, and I think it was quite touched on during the Diggers and Dealers Forum, this whole idea that companies are not only responsible for how much money they make or how good they are for the environment, but also about protecting their employees. So it has been discussed a lot. whether the walk is being walked will yet to be seen, but there are policies that are being brought out. So some companies have placed 4 drink limits on their on-site FIFO employees, and that's really aimed at stamping out bad behaviour due to alcohol. There's been some work in better anonymous reporting, and obviously the expectations on employees has grown a lot. Our state government hasn't formally responded to the inquiry, and up until my chat with the Minister for Mines and Petroleum, Bill Johnston, at Diggers, they had remained really tight-lipped about sort of their approach to the report and their response.
I mean, there's a lot of people that have been talking about this. I think even the WA Premier, Mark McGowan, was asked about it. Did you expect that this would get so much attention? Obviously, you knew in your community, but did you think that it'd be discussed more widely across WA and across the country as well?
Yeah, so it was also on the front page of the West Australian, which is our state's daily newspaper. So I did kind of expect a little bit of public commentary across the state, but I didn't expect, you know, the Premier to get up there and say that I had his support, and he was a bit disappointed in what had happened. The opposition leader, she also got up, Mia Davies, and shared her support. And I've had countless leaders and politicians and CEOs and stuff like that reach out to me personally and share their support as well. So I thought it would get a little bit of attention, but I didn't expect to be on the news and making headlines myself.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird situation for a journalist to be in, and I'm sure it's been a really exhausting and flat-out week. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to us on Hack. Amber Lilly, Deputy Editor of the Kalgoorlie Miner. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And I should say that the chairman of the Digger and Dealers Mining Forum provided a statement to Hack. Jim Walker said he was saddened and disappointed to learn of the alleged incident. He said while it didn't occur at a Diggers and Dealers event, that the forum has a zero tolerance policy towards such behaviour and supports the mining community's efforts to encourage inclusive behaviour.
Hack. I found after a few weeks I was just really worn down. It was tiring.
On Triple J.
You know, it can be hard enough figuring out if you need mental health support. But trying to find some can be even harder, especially if you're in the country. And for one regional Victorian community, things have just got a whole lot worse because two of the local mental health not-for-profits have collapsed, and it means hundreds of vulnerable people have been left without support. And experts say that this is a symptom of some pretty big failures in funding models across the country, and there are some really important lessons to be learnt. Rio Davis has this story.
As a worker, it's been, that's probably the hardest part of it, is losing that, just the team around you. Because, you know, obviously in this job, you do have your rough days where things can get a bit hairy or a bit hard. And you, we always had that office to go back and debrief and talk about things and unload, where now we don't really have that.
For NDIS mental health worker Mitch Collier, the shutdown of regional mental health not-for-profit within Australia was not just the loss of a home, but also the loss of steady work.
It was a family, basically. I've never worked in a place like it. Just everyone just loved it. It was just a home away from home if people need to get out. So that's, yeah, the biggest hit, I think, was just not having that home base for everyone to go to.
Within offered group sessions in cooking, social outings and skills for people with mental illness in eastern Victoria. Mitch thought he was finally in a secure job when it shut down pretty suddenly last month. He and 60 other workers were made redundant and 400 clients with mental illness were left to find new service providers. Mitch has now gone independent and is trying to hold together the community that grew it within.
Within had been running for 30 years in Banstall. Like, I've got clients personally that have been there for 15, 16 years.
Other workers like Mitch are going out of their way to soften what was a pretty sudden blow.
The people that are running those groups, they're really good at what they do, so I believe the people will be encouraged to keep going. And if it does fizzle out, then yeah, it's not, shouldn't make too much of an impact.
A lot of mental health providers are in the not-for-profit space. Think big names like Beyond Blue or Lifeline. Unlike private psychologists or GP clinics and government-run agencies, not-for-profits rely on things like grants, charity partners, and fundraising to operate. For years, Within wasn't making any money, and as a not-for-profit, it wasn't meant to. But when it lost a key government contract that was subsidising the rest of its services, it had no choice but to close its doors. Within isn't the only mental health not-for-profit that shut down in Gippsland in the last month. Advocacy group Barrier Breakers was founded nearly 20 years ago to help people navigate the complex mental health care system.
It'd be devastating for us all because we've all done our best to fill a gap that still exists in the Gippsland region for people who have mental illness and have nowhere to go and nowhere to seek assistance.
Founder Derek Amos says they survived off community donations, volunteers and small government grants until last month.
Application after application have been made to state governments, federal governments since then for an ongoing stream of funds to provide for the type of advocacy services that Barrier Breakers provide. Provided, I was going to say provides, but past tense now, but all been unsuccessful.
So why are we seeing these long-standing not-for-profit services collapse now, after so many years? Patrick McGorry is a psychiatrist known around the world for his work in the youth mental health space. He reckons there's been a lack of security and longevity in mental health care funding, and it's leading to the closure of local not-for-profits.
It's a failure of the primary health network model. They are supposed to commission services and they're supposed to integrate care, and they've often done the reverse. They've fragmented care with this competitive model, a tendering model that they have been asked to follow. And also their contracting periods are so short that there's constant churn, instability, insecurity. That's a map failed by the PHNs all around Australia. They've been encouraged to have more longer term contracting periods by the department now, I believe, and that's definitely something that's really very, very important.
He also thinks the government agencies pitting providers against one another with competitive tender processes needs to stop.
it fragments care and makes care more unstable. The dollars are sort of spread around the community in a dilute way rather than doing it with economies of scale. So you get smaller entities and it's destructive competition where what you're looking for is collaboration and cooperation, which is more part of the way we work in health. I just think it's been a chronic problem, this approach. And there should be much more of a planned and structured approach with much more government influence and control.
But now that he's out of a secure job, mental health worker Mitch is just trying to stay positive to keep caring for his clients as best he can.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, it's not too bad. The support network we had around each other was really good, and we've continued to keep that. I guess in a different capacity, might just be over the phone now instead of in the office.
Hack on Triple J.
Rio Davis there in that story produced by Angel Parsons. And remember, if you ever need someone to speak with, Lifeline is always there. You can grab them on 13 11 14. We're hearing from you on the text line. It's a big issue. Dr. Eric in Yamba in New South Wales says it's bloody outrageous. As a GP, I struggle to find mental health support for my patients on a daily basis, and we're not even remote. Yeah, we're going to keep on this because mental health services, big issues for you right around the country. And we heard that loud and clear when we were travelling around for the election tour. This is something that, you know, you want answers to, so we'll keep on it. Something a little bit different now.
Hack, did you know you can use raw lamb testicles instead of mozzarella for a caprese salad?
On Triple J.
Delicious.
Oh, I don't know about that. But if you're an athlete or maybe just someone who cares a lot about your physical performance, you've probably made some big changes to your diet before. There's a heap of eating plans, advice out there. Some are more extreme than others. Then there's the carnivore diet. It's meat eating. A lot of people swear by it. It includes a heap of influencers, but there aren't too many qualified nutritionists who recommend it. Not only that, there is a massive overlap between the diet's online followers with red-pilled communities, so people who subscribe to everything from men's rights activism to white supremacy. Obviously, I'm not saying everyone who's into this diet is in these communities. There's definitely a crossover, though. The ABC's new pop culture podcast, Schmeitgeist, has been looking into this one, and its host, Ange Lavoie-Pierre, has this story. And just a warning, it contains some graphic content.
The carnivore diet is a kind of religion in certain corners of the internet, and its high priests are male, hyper-macho social media influencers, like Paul Saladino, also known as Carnivore MD.
Why would you ever seek leaves, stems, roots, and seeds? Animal foods are what your ancestors have always sought. This is totally clear.
As with all religions, you might be asked to make sacrifices, like certain kinds of cheese.
Did you know you can use raw lamb testicles instead of mozzarella for a caprese salad? Delicious.
In exchange, though, there's salvation. Just ask hard right figure Jordan Peterson.
I need way less sleep. I get up in the morning and I'm fine. I'm not anxious. I'm not depressed. I don't have psoriasis. My legs were numb on the sides. That's gone.
Curtis.
Hi, how you going?
So I'm talking to Curtis Sirenin. You might recognise that name if you're a league fan. He's played for Manly and for West's Tigers. And I'm speaking to him because not only is he a meat convert, but he also seems like a lovely guy. He speaks at a regular volume and has nothing to do with the alt-right.
I was basically fully carnivore for probably 18 months. Had a bit of an injury history. I went 5 or 6 years where I had surgery every season and I was sort of just battling.
Even though he was pretty skeptical about the diet at first, ultimately it worked for him.
Fasting from 8 p.m. till midday every day and then breaking a fast with 3 or 4 ribeye steaks with bone broth, you know, having oysters every second day. Honestly, probably a fortnight I started just feeling the effects and those sort of achy little pains starting to wear off, which, you know, that was sort of my goal.
So before going any further, I wanted to hear from a food and nutrition scientist. This is Dr. Emma Beckett from the University of Newcastle.
There are potential consequences in terms of eating too much meat. And if you're only eating meat, it's very likely you will be eating too much meat.
The conventional nutritional wisdom goes something like this. Too much meat increases the risk of having too much of the bad kind of saturated fat, and that is associated with heart disease. Emma says it also means you might be missing out on other essentials like fibre, vitamin C and vitamin K.
Not all these things manifest immediately. The body's really good at what we call homeostasis. And homeostasis is keeping things in the normal situation. So we're eating not just for our health today, but we're eating for our health next week, next month, next year, 10 years, 20 years, hopefully.
Okay, my name is Dr. Kaz Ross, and I do research on the far right, in particular in Australia.
So Kaz started to notice this pattern really kicking off with conservative-leaning men online in 2015. And then it got a massive boost.
By 2018, it's really built to a frenzy when Jordan Peterson, who is a huge influence in the alt-right, goes on the Joe Rogan podcast, the most subscribed to and watched podcast in the world, and talks about his all-meat diet.
And that endorsement from Jordan Peterson vaulted the carnivore diet to a whole new level with the people she watches, including at the furthest end of that spectrum.
And then I see that some of the main Nazi leaders in Australia are, you know, really talking about do not eat carbs, they are not your friends, they are enemies, you should be eating raw eggs, raw milk and lots more meat. Bread is evil.
So what's the common thread? Kaz says it boils down to hierarchies, whether that's to do with race, gender, or the food chain. And Kaz thinks that's the glue binding meat diets to red pill thinking.
Underlying for them is this notion that not all people are equal, that there's a natural hierarchy in the world. They embrace inequality.
Of course, there are plenty of people out there who really are just on this diet for what they hope are health benefits. People like Curtis. So where does this overlap lead them?
If you start making claims about society and cultures and ranking different cultures or cultural beliefs and practices along with your dietary advice and how to cook your bit of meat, it's time to sort of take a step back and think, well, what else is coming along with this?
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, and if you want to hear more on this, there's a whole podcast that's diving into it, a whole lot more discussion. You'll be able to hear more from those interviews. It's called Schmartgeist, the podcast. It's an ABC podcast. You can find it in all the usual places. And hey, there's so many comments coming through on this. Kristen in Baxter says, yuck, the carnivore diet? I think modern humans' risk of heart disease is high enough, thank you. But another person says yes to the carnivore diet. It's incredible. No bloating, no brain fog. Plus, polycystic ovary syndrome and endometriosis pain are gone after years of pain. Something worked. Another person says they were having issues with irritable bowel syndrome and they've never felt better since, you know, removing vegetable products. But then another person, check out the groups around the world who have no access to vegetables. Their lifespans are short. What a stupid movement. Very dangerous. And Sean from Bendigo says, if Jordan Peterson's a supporter of the carnivore diet, that tells me all I need to know.
Hack! I love playing, though. It's amazing, but, you know, it's like, I can't do this forever.
On Triple J.
Serena Williams. You hear her name and a whole bunch of words come to mind. Champion, great, icon. She's all of those things to so many people around the world. And you can know nothing about tennis, but a whole lot about Serena Williams because she's not just an American 23-time tennis Grand Slam singles champion. She's a cultural force. But Serena Williams is retiring, although she's not really calling it that. She says it's an evolution away from tennis. And it could be happening after the US Open, which starts next month, so really soon. This is huge news, and we want to explore what it means a bit more. So I've got with me now Marley Silver. Marley co-hosts the Sport and Spice podcast on ABC Sport. She's a Dungutty and Gamilaroi woman. Hey, Marley. Thanks so much for coming on Hack.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me. This is certainly news that broke my heart a bit today.
I bet. So you're a big Serena fan, obviously.
Yes, I've quite often been asked, you know, who's your favourite athlete of all time, and she's always my go-to answer, I think, because she's such an enigma, and it's certainly going to be a loss for so many sports fans when she does finally hang up the racket.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing that's even more heartbreaking about this was the tone of the announcement, right? Because she wrote this piece where she talks about it and she said, there's no happiness in this topic for me. I know it's not the usual thing to say, but I feel a great deal of pain. It's the hardest thing that I could ever imagine. I hate it. I mean, that's heartbreaking, Marley.
Absolutely. In that piece, she had a pretty nice nod to our one and only Ash Barty and how she was able to leave the sport at number one and make that decision very much on her own terms and be super happy about it. And there was certainly a little bit of, I guess, maybe not envy, but, you know, reflection of the fact that she doesn't feel like that. And there's such a gendered element to this as well, which I think is really interesting and an important reminder that even if you are, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, one of the greatest athletes of all time, you're still going to be impacted about the fact that you are a woman and your experience is different. So she spoke about if she was a man, she wouldn't be having to be at this crossroad where she's considering this because she wants to continue to grow her family. So I think that while this is, yeah, certainly bittersweet to hear that she's going to be leaving the sport where she doesn't necessarily want to. Hopefully, I mean, the legacy that she has is what we're going to remember her for.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, as you said, she did talk about like the juggling of family and the big concerns that she's had for many years, and we're seeing women athletes speaking out a lot about this at the moment, the challenges of staying in sport while juggling everything. What about the cultural kind of influence of Serena Williams as well, because it's a lot further than the tennis court, right? Like, her influence goes far beyond that.
Yeah, I think her story and her legacy, like you said, it is so much more than tennis. Across her career, we've seen her have influence, you know, in things as diverse as fashion, you know, and then also how we talk about race and what it means in the sporting world and in pop culture. You know, she's, at the end of the day, she was this black woman from Compton, LA. She changed, you know, the answer to the question of who's allowed to play tennis and who can be a tennis fan. And that certainly was spread out across all different sorts of sports. And it's no longer, you know, in tennis in particular, it's no longer a sport that's all just, you know, whiteness and the wealth of sort of what we expect when we think of Wimbledon. It's a sport that anyone, you know, can be a part of because of someone like her. So, you know, you just think, when, like you mentioned in the introduction of this, like she's synonymous with tennis, but she's also someone who is a cultural force in being able to challenge people's expectations, you know, whether it is in what it means to be a successful athlete, what it means to use your voice and your influence. And I think particularly in this piece, in her talking about the difficulties in, you know, having to think about retirement and why this has come up. She's showing that she understands her position as a leader to challenge people to think about how things have to get better. Like you said, we're having lots of these conversations about female athletes at the moment. And, you know, maybe it's going to force the hand of some of these institutions in sport and beyond to think about how they can better support women to be both mothers and working athletes.
Yeah, definitely some really big conversations there. Marley, you said you've been a fan for ages, one of your favourite sports people in the world. Did you expect it to happen so soon? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about it, hasn't there? But were you thinking, yeah, this might be the year?
You know what? I think I'm still reeling after losing Ash Barty in the sport that I hadn't even been thinking that this would be this close. You know, she hasn't quite felt like her heart's been as in it as it was before she had her daughter. I think that was not necessarily because of the fact that she took that time off to be a mother, but more because if you would remember back in 2018 in the US Open when she lost to Naomi Osaka, and there was a big uproar with the way that she reacted and her criticism of the calls by the umpire, and there was a big discussion around the, you know, perpetuation of the angry black woman trope that came with that. And I think that really affected her. But I think also, you know, if you, it seems to me to be a kind of, a product of a few things layering on top of each other that it's come to this point. It's, I mean, it is disappointing. You always want someone who is, you know, a goat in many ways.
Yeah.
to be able to finish on a big high. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like it's that's going to happen.
Definitely, definitely a sad day for so many sports fans, tennis fans, Serena Williams fans. Really appreciate you, Marley Silver from the Sport and Spice podcast, coming on and explaining that. And yeah, make sure you check out that podcast, by the way, because Marley's co-host is our very own Declan Byrne. It's a great time. Lots of good chats. Thanks so much, Marley.
Thanks for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
And that is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.